Welcome to Notice That, an EMDR podcast. Here, you will find discussion on all things EMDR from MDRI-approved trainers and consultants, as well as some co-hosts. EMDR is an approach to the entire therapeutic journey, not just reprocessing trauma. This podcast will feature a discussion on the therapeutic relationship, understanding and using the original eight-phase protocol, and what to do to bring deeper understanding to the why behind EMDR and what to do when you're stuck. This podcast is an invitation to connect and learn together about EMDR and the process of psychotherapy. We are glad that you're here.
Thanks for checking out this podcast. Notice That is a project of Think Beyond, a listener-funded media house focused on connecting humans through therapy and art. To keep this podcast going, we'd love for you to support us on Patreon by searching patreon.com/thinkbeyondhealing in your favorite web browser. And don't forget to check out our new merch by going to our website at connectbeyondhealing.com and clicking on the merchandise tab. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to Notice That, an EMDR podcast. It is Melissa and I, Bridger, here together in the virtual studio in our separate homes on a rainy Missouri day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we're going to pick back up in our Back to Basics series, working through Francine Shapiro's seminal text on EMDR and basic principles and protocols. And today we're going to finish chapter 6, where we're kind of picking up in a weird space experientially with starting the conversation on installation. So we'll do a little bit of remembering to get us kind of into the vibe of phases 4 and 5 as a whole. So Melissa, how are you today?
I'm pretty good. I'm enjoying our weather. My creeks are filling and my animals are nervous. So if you put your dog in the background, forgive me.
Yes.
And my dogs don't like stormy days.
Yes. You may hear a crash of thunder or two as well. So I'll see what I can do about that in post, but it might come through.
We will see.
Yes. Before we get started, we have a couple things coming up on the Institute's course calendar. Just to keep in mind, if you've been waiting to get into an SIP Foundations course, that's coming up in May. The dates are May 30th through June 1st. Then we also have one at kind of the beginning of August, August 8th through the 10th. So mark your calendars for those. And one thing that I did want to mention, if you are listening to this and have already taken SIP, you can take it again for free.
Anytime.
I don't know if people know that.
Yeah, we should tell them.
I know, and that's what we're doing now. but you can take it for free. You can join virtually. It's a little bit more complicated to join in person for free just because the space is limited. But on Zoom, you can just go into the Mighty Networks page, your course in somatic integration and processing, and you'll see a little live indicator during the training, which means you can have access to that event. So please pop on, and that's a great way for you to stay kind of fresh on SIP-related concepts. And just because we're subjective humans, our explanation of each concept tends to change, not necessarily the mechanics of the concept, but just how we talk about it. And so that's also another opportunity to hear another take on some of those core concepts. And I just think, subjectively, it would be really rad to have people that have taken SIP in the mix. One, just to give
sharing their experience. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Sharing their experience and getting to come alongside clinicians that are in their first experience of SIP outside of what they've heard on the podcast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be super fun. I think we estimated the other day, there's probably about 1,000 humans out there that have gone through SIP 1.
Yep.
And that is pretty exciting. And so
pretty cool.
So if you are an SIP 1 alum and want to come back,
that's right.
Yeah.
What that means to me, and I think to all of us here at the Institute, but just to say it, like, not only does that mean 1,000 people have interacted with SIP, but that means there is a growing culture of language that more and more people have access to. That's one of the things I hear about so often in consultation is that I just wish I had a group of people that I could talk about these things with like this. Like nowhere else can I get into things like this with people.
Yeah. Yeah. And we have kind of intentionally created community where that's exactly what could happen, which is so fun and so enlivening. And we get to experience the richness of it in our small little world here in Springfield. But then the fact that it is growing and spreading across the globe is pretty fun for all of us.
Pretty fun. And it reminds me of a conversation you and I were having yesterday about immersion and the kind of slow
marination.
The marination, exactly. Yes. that's for clinicians that are a part of the community that seem to have really, taken hold of SIP and that it's starting to make its way into every facet of their work. It's in part because they are immersed in the culture. They're talking with people regularly. This is a really hard training to have just on your shelf, I took it, a year or two ago and I haven't really gone back to it since. This is a hard training to have in that category because of how depth oriented and immersive it is.
Yeah. And if you were a brand new listener and have no idea what we're talking about, SIP is Somatic Integration and Processing, which is our case conceptualization model that we use to pair with EMDR and explain the complex presentations that we get into with our clients and just make sense of all of the different layers of things that we end up working with in the EMDR process and beyond.
Yeah. Bit of a hot take, but in the spirit of Caleb, who I just had a conversation with, SIP helps us go where AIP leaves off. That the past influencing the present, or that symptoms in the present are based in past memories. There's so much more to the story than just that. So SIP helps us, yes, go back to that element of AIP, but then understand why the traumas were processed the way they were, why it hurt so bad, or why it doesn't seem to resolve naturally for the individual.
And how do we be with it in the present, regarding explicit traumatic memory that we're processing with EMDR or a attachment wound that requires long-term relational healing, all of the above.
Or something going on in the body, right?
Or something going on in the body. Imagine that.
Imagine that.
So speaking of something going on in the body, shall we have an embodied immersion straight into a EMDR session and imagine that we are in that crucial transition moment between phase 4 and phase 5?
Yeah, let me just tap that in a little
bit. I know, notice that a little bit, right?
Yeah, evoke it.
So, yeah. So experientially, we would be in that moment where we have found a significant shift that is expressed as the SUD is zero or almost zero. And we have likely seen big adaptive shifts occur, material come forward, things are transforming, the client is feeling some kind of expansiveness or relaxation around whatever we were just processing. And we get the sense that maybe we're ready to shift from phase 4 into phase 5.
Yes. Yes. Sometimes for me, there's like a beautiful version of this where it is just what you were kind of depicting, where it is the moment that is ready for us. That, we have felt the body open up and these kind of reprocessing expressions come forward and we're ready to just naturally move into phase 5 and beyond. Other times, installation is sort of held up by the arrest of the SUDs not moving or the target not moving, and we have to make a choice point kind of at this intersection. Unfinished targets, all those types of things that can come up here. But this is a somewhat, natural turning point where we're either going to go into closure to try and wrap up or contain a memory that is still giving activation or it's not moving. or we're ready to kind of transition into that just beautiful installation and really ground the meaning of the process that we just went through.
Or the third option, everything has gone well. We've reached something like a zero sud and I've run out of time.
Yes.
Very practically. And I think like experientially, the running out of time in session is just a very real issue that we're all kind of contending with around closure of sessions, complete, incomplete, or like we were completing, but now we just don't have time. And how do we navigate all of that? So when we get to phase seven and talking about closure, I think all of that is relevant.
Yep. All of that. So for you that, you know, listening, imagine back to your sessions of being in this kind of choice. I see it like a, we've got multiple options depending on the context that we're in. If we're at that precious moment of all the activation is there, we're moving into the installation phase and we've got 20 or so minutes or 15 minutes left, then we can make that choice. But if we are up to the clock's end and need to make that choice for container or just kind of pressing pause, remember what that feels like to be mm-hmm. in that space with your clients. Mm-hmm. Very cool. So with that, we're going to kind of move as the chapter does, which is kind of straightforward from desensitization and reprocessing into installation. That's the first point, phase five, that we're going to be talking about today. So with this, you're getting those sensations that the sud has gone down to zero, or what the EMDR world calls an ecological position, where for whatever reason, it can't go to a full zero. They give several examples of why that might be the case. But for me, typically, it's when there's something about the existing context of the memory and or its current meaning in life that there's still going to be some natural activation around it. So we don't mm-hmm. actually want it to go all the way to zero because it's potentially something that is still real for them. One example that's coming up for me is working with a survivor of domestic violence,
right?
And those memories being somewhat resolved down to a one or a two, but the ever-pressing fear that, well, it could happen again. Mm-hmm. And that's where there's still work to be done, but on those original memories that sort of laid the foundational templates for the vulnerability that ultimately led them to get wrapped up in a DV situation, that's where we're okay with a one.
Yeah. Another example that I think it's important for us to kind of keep in mind of where an ecological zero or maybe even an ecological two or three, if they're going to be such. The case where I feel like we have to remember that that is likely and maybe even adaptive is in the case of racially motivated traumas. We're currently in a systemic situation where for racially motivated trauma to drop to a zero is a little bit nonsensical, potentially, depending on the situation. And that person, that body is still in full awareness that it is by no means safe yet, right? For them to be who they are in a public space. And so we're not going to expect a zero in that context. And so I think there's a lot of traumas that we could get each ecological one, two, or three, depending on if that is a part of the picture.
Yeah. I remember early on in my EMDR practice, just in the way that it's trained, it's sometimes like inevitable that the feeling of we're not done yet seeps in with an ecological one or two. Mm-hmm. Like it is a heavy and somewhat kind of sacred or like precious realization to see the privilege in the room. Like I, as the therapist, want this to go down to a zero for you. I want mm-hmm. to do everything I can, but we meet the limits of our ability when the preceding context or the real context for the client is one that, just as you were saying, that a zero is unimaginable and perhaps impossible or, right. you know, insensitive or prejudiced even to expect that it would go down to a zero. And so that's been a bit of a space for me in consultation with people in certification that it's not immediately we're not immediately aware of what an ecological one is. Like there's context behind it that we don't really understand for that client. We can't, mm-hmm. we're not them. But to be sensitive and curious about, is this meaningful for it to stay at a one? Or is mm-hmm. it that I keep pushing, I can't get it to move, and so I'm just going to leave it at one or yes. two?
There is a huge difference. Yeah. Well, and to be honest, like I am pretty, what's a good word? The one that came to mind is pushy. So there's like that.
Consistent or expectant.
I want the zero. Like I'm pretty tenacious. There's a good
tenacious.
Word. I'm pretty tenacious about getting the zero because anytime that we leave something behind, it has the potential of being triggered in the future. And I don't like to do that unless there's a very good reason for it. So I think like my personal check, because my tenacity is an asset, but can also be privileged and problematic. The self-check for me is, do I understand why this is there? And even if I don't personally resonate with why it's there, can the client and I make sense together, meaning that it resonates for them why this is remaining? And usually there's almost kind of a desire for it to stay. Right? Mm-hmm. The body is communicating, no, I need this little bit of distress. This is adaptive still in my system. Because EMDR can only process out what is no longer relevant to their reality. And so if that distress is still relevant to their reality, which is going to be determined by the client, not by me, then it will stay. Even if they, you know, people please and fawn into convincing me that it's a zero when it actually isn't, if I seem too pushy about it.
Do
right?
clients do that?
Maybe a little bit.
Yes. The answer is absolutely, unequivocally. Absolutely. Yes.
And so I think that is a point of a lot of balance of, I want to be pushy in the sense of giving the body a chance and giving the body permission to release what it previously thought was irreleasable, not able to let go, because we can release what is no longer relevant to our reality. But there is going to be that point where we come to an understanding that this is going to stay because it is still their reality.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, to me, a good segue into the, you know, script-oriented facets of the installation phase where clarification and discovery is possible mm-hmm. when you're holding that type of posture that you just spoke to of, I want to understand why, even though I don't or perhaps can't personally resonate with the reasoning behind the ecological yeah. positioning. So typically this phase is made up of the, you know, positive cognition, reprompting that, mm-hmm. saying, do the words, whatever their positive cognition was, still fit, or does something else resonate? And allowing the client to, in that question, reflect on the process and yeah. kind of remember back to the beginning of the assessment phase and discover if things have shifted in a way that perhaps a new positive cognition has come forward. One example of that to me is the positive cognition seems outlandish on the assessment, like I'll never be hurt again. Like that's what they'd like to believe, versus the positive cognition shifting into something like, even if I am hurt, I know that I'll be okay. Something yeah. like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, you know, there's a couple of usual patterns here. Like sometimes it's going to be exactly what they wanted it to be and thought it would be at the beginning. That's a possibility. It's also very common that it's a big escalation in positive. Like they are kind of now in that zone of, oh, I could never have imagined feeling this way, but suddenly I do, right? Because of what was processed. I remember early on, I think it was in my certification process, we had to trade and work on each other, which was an interesting requirement.
Oh.
So I drove to Joplin, Missouri and paired up with somebody that was in my certification group. And I remember that in that process, I started with the positive cognition of I matter. You know, negative cognition was I am nothing. Positive cognition, I matter. And by the end of it, the positive cognition was I am powerful, right? Mm. There was like such a dramatic shift. It's like, oh, no, I'm like totally over the question of do I matter or not.
Mattering
like
is irrelevant now.
Like, irrelevant. Like I am effing powerful, right? And it was so sweet to like watch my body in action because it had to be recorded. And when I watched it back, it's like, oh, there was full embodiment because I, you know, the adaptive nature of it, you move into more adult energy.
100%.
You know, that adult energy comes online is like, no, I am so much more than what that child state was feeling. And so that's a really common experience too, if they get access to it, a whole different set of adaptive beliefs. Yeah.
And just to highlight the viscerality of that feeling, like even as you were describing it for those, because you can't see us obviously, but Melissa was saying like, you know, I matter, was saying I matter from like a very like head nodding, like still place. And then as soon as effing powerful came up, like shoulders opened up, you like elongated the spine, you sat up. Like that's the type of energy that I'm looking for, regardless of what the words are. That's when I know that a positive cognition is doing what I hoped it to do. And that's where, again, for me, sometimes, again, not to argue with the client in any way or try and, you know, put in what I want, but this is a point where I'll kind of check on that positive cognition if they're still kind of sunken and they'll say, you know, if I say do the words, whatever they were, still fit. And they're like, kind of nodding. It's like, I'm wondering if there is something a little bit deeper then, because as you said it to me, and I'll kind of mirror that back to them and see how they, you know, if there is something beyond it that still feels kind of out of reach, or maybe they want to change it, but they don't know exactly how to say it. Like I'm looking for that body to click and express and open just the way you did.
Yeah, it's so interesting, Bridget. I think it's on page 152, the third paragraph down. The note that I made in the margin was the embodied check of the positive connection. And that's what we're talking about. Like, is the body showing signs of responding in this sort of expansive, enlivening way to that positive cognition? So this highlights another kind of common experience that I'm curious what your thoughts are. When somebody gives the positive cognition at the beginning and it's already a seven, and like, what do you do right there?
This is a brilliant space that we could have an entire episode on. I make sense of it in multiple ways, and it is really particular to the client therapist dyad in my experience. There's a particular type of person that in recounting one of the most horrific things that's ever happened to them and then prompted for what would you like to believe about yourself instead, give a cognition that then shows up as a seven.
Right.
That's a particular type of person.
I agree.
And for me,
what kind of person that is?
Well, not to objectify, but for me, the point is actually in the mechanism of the intersubjective space, the space between the therapist and the client. Because the way I make sense of that in my body, if a client says that to me, is it's in some way a well-intentioned wishful thinking.
Yeah.
That whether it's motivated by what they want me to perceive in them, and or it's a part of them that wants it to be true. I sometimes talk about this as dissociative projection, that I just talked about how egregious this experience was. And then you gave me an opportunity to intellectualize out of it. And I already believe this positive cognition, when on the paper, it would be like a does not equal sign. Like, you know, it would have a slash through. Yes, yes. So for me, that's where my curiosity starts, is what's in the information transformation process that just created such a poignant juxtaposition?
I agree. Yeah, what I was thinking about in that is the version of it where it is a fantasy, right? Yes. That I am imagining that I already believe that, right? And so it does indicate a pretty significant dissociation between my cognitive self and my embodied self. Because my embodied self said, this is what I want to believe. And then my cognitive self said, well, I already believe that.
Yeah.
It's just a very interesting split that happens. One of the spots, certainly not the only reason, but one of the spots where I see this a lot is if somebody has done a lot of CBT. And they have sort of had a lot of practice at talking themselves into a new belief, but the body may or may not have been brought along depending on the style of CBT they were receiving. And so they really can be having this experience of, no, I know this is true. Like, and I believe it, like I'm all the way there in the sense of belief, but does my body know how to sense the meaning of this belief? No.
Yeah.
And that, you know, later on, we're going to get into this conversation about phase six. And when we're in that body scan moment, that's one of the reasons why phase six happens after the installation, I think, because we can still be navigating a little bit of that dissociative split that can occur between my embodied sensing self and my cognitive knowing self. And that's one of the ways the protocol tries to change.
Yeah. One of the ways I think about that is when I feel that in the assessment phase, I just learned something that has to be true for this individual. And by the has to be true, I mean that this is a buffer that they have created in order to avoid the terror and tragedy of the intensity of the experience right. that they've gone through. And so it's a, just like you're saying, it's an intellectualization. It's a cognitively oriented objectification of the self that says you don't have to feel because I already know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now I don't want this to be overgeneralized when I say it. This is one of those slippery slope kind of comments. So everybody be aware of that as I'm saying it, but it is one of the indicators that I look for if this is happening habitually. That we might be dealing with a personality disordered strategy. If somebody is highly committed to like, this is the belief that must be true and a rejection of any experience to the contrary, that level of rigidity in the system might be not universally true, but might be an indicator that there's a pretty rigid personality strategy that we could bump into quite a bit. And that can make the standard protocol pretty tricky to navigate.
Yeah. The overlap between personality and dissociative presentations here is tricky. And it's one, again, not to objectify away from what they're actually experiencing, but just to become curious at that type of report. Because it's a juxtaposition that's begging to be explored. Like, it's
just looking a strange. At the pattern.
Yeah. The pattern is the point.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that fun little rabbit trail.
Absolutely.
I was reading.
Yes, absolutely. So the installation, we just kind of left off with repeating the positive cognitions. Then we're going to go into the event to reevaluate where is that validity of cognition. Bringing up, you know, think of the event, hold it together with the words positive cognition that fit. And then we're going to check with a couple sets.
Yeah. Yeah, it's basically the co-activation of the way that the memory is stored now after the reprocessing and mm-hmm. the way that positive belief is currently held. And we're basically trying to let them talk to each other.
Yeah.
And co-activating.
Mm-hmm. I underlined this sentence on 153. The increase in validity may continue well past the arbitrary level of 7 on the Vogue scale.
I noticed that. Too,
since right. the client is often initially unaware of how positive and right a cognition can actually feel.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And to me, that's sort of the embodied piece of like, okay, they say it's a 7, but like how 7 can a 7 get, right? With that statement, I am powerful. Like, is there an expression of empowerment in the body that they could feel that they haven't felt yet? And, you know, Francine in that section, she says, keep going as long as it is increasing, as long as the positive experience is expanding, don't stop just because they say it's a 7. Let them relish it and continue to marinate in it for as long as they are getting more.
Yes. And this is also one of the few moments that in Francine's own words, it's highlighted that these scales are arbitrary. She just yeah. said it, arbitrary level of 7. And this yeah. is where the conviction and grip that I feel clinicians want out of the objectively seeming, you know, strength of these numerical scales, it's just an indicator. It's just a way of subjectively assessing the movement of something that without some of these more objective instruments can feel elusive and kind of mysterious. Like we don't have a way to talk about it. But I just love highlighting, somewhat from my own bias, the way that Francine herself recognized them as arbitrary.
Yeah. Yeah. But it also means that it might be just as valid to track the increase of the positive belief in the form of an internal symbol.
Yeah.
Right. If they're seeing a version of themselves that is powerful and they keep getting bigger. I had this happen recently where the adult self that appeared in the scene, like literally kept getting bigger and bigger until they were as big as the whole world. Right.
Yeah.
Like, well, we're going to keep going. Like, do they want to get cosmologically large? Like how big can this get? And it got as big as the whole world and then it stopped. This is the indicator that that's just as valid in terms of tracking that positive cognition of I am powerful as a seven. And I would say that symbol of myself as large as the world is probably more meaningful to them in the long run than, oh, I have a VOC of seven on this statement.
Yes. So what do you make of a VOC of five or six?
Well, okay. So, so many things, and obviously there's like context dependent stuff all over the place.
Yeah.
But I conceptualize that as most of me is there, but then there is some part of me that either is in disagreement or might agree, but is afraid, right? Is nervous about the implications of what it would let this get to a seven. To use that same example, most of me might be ready to feel as big as my whole world, that I can handle whatever life brings me. But then there might be a small part of me that is holding the concern of, wait a second, if I get that powerful, how am I going to call in care from others, right? How am I going to reconcile the continued need for relational attachment if I'm not self-sufficient? Right? Because there could be an old attachment wound that's still kind of buzzing with that concern. And so it to me is kind of helpful to conceptualize that in that way, that most of me might be there, but then there's a part of me that still has a concern about it.
Yeah. To plug it into the same context that we were using for the ecological one or two, I think there's, and I've not heard people outside of the Institute talk like this, that I think there's a relationship between the ecological positioning of the sud and the voc, there could be good reason that even though in themselves, like you're saying, there is a belief and an authentically grounded discovery of newfound, strength or resilience or whatever the characterization of that positive cognition is, but there's mm-hmm. something systemically going on that mm-hmm. undermines the expressive ability of that positive cognition and its newfound, trait change level implication that, well, I'm fine with it in me, but as soon as I go out there, just to what you mm-hmm. were saying, that mm-hmm. maybe I'm not ready for the way my environment will respond to this.
Right. And the degree to which the person is aware of the systemic implications of their internal change is going to have a big impact on how enthusiastic they are about that being a seven.
Yeah.
For instance, that example that I gave about my own reprocessing session, I went home that day and had a massive fight with my partner because I was feeling quite powerful.
Right. Ready to be powerful.
Yeah, I was there. And so, suddenly I'm in the midst of an experience that says, oh, my power might have some downsides, right? I might have some prices to pay in the context of this being true, but I wasn't in consciousness of that in the midst of the session. It only happened after the fact. But some of our clients are going to be super conscious of what that means relationally for them.
Yeah.
And I would say that that can also be the internal relationships with self. Right. The sort of internal family constellation can be deeply impacted, and then also the external environment.
Yeah. This is reminding me of a client that I had that it wasn't until the closure phase. Again, these aren't demarcated so cleanly in session a lot of times, but it wasn't until the closure phase that the 7 that we found in the installation actually went down to a 4. He said, I was thinking about that, you know, the cognition of I'm okay to be myself. And my wife's face popped into my head.
Yikes. Yeah.
And now I don't believe that anymore. Mm-hmm. And that was a really clear depiction to me of what we're talking about, where, yes, the work we did on past stuff was absolutely resonant now with the belief that it's okay to be me. And right. He had some variations. It was like, I'm good, or, you know, something like that. And then once he was feeling the undercurrent of closure, which is I'm getting ready to leave this office. Mm-hmm. It's like the systemic pressures that were confronting and exploiting pre-existing vulnerabilities showed up again really strong. And then that proceeded into all kinds of fear.
Yeah. Well, and that reminds me of something you've been talking about a lot lately, of what happens when we sort of shift from the single person psychology to the, you know, multiple person psychology, of really kind of embedding what we're doing in the larger context of the thing.
Yeah.
To me, that's a great example of that, of, oh, that would be fine if I was a single person psychology.
Yes. If I was just in a bubble, that was.
Yeah, and then I could do it. Yeah. Yes. But the practical application is, very, very significant. And that doesn't mean that the experience of feeling the 7 was not incredibly helpful, because now the body is actually feeling the tension between the possibility of what I could feel and how that possibility meets my reality. And now we have tension between desire and reality. And there's a lot of therapeutic work that can happen right there in that tension, and would then beget probably a lot of interesting reflection on the marriage, et cetera. And that's exactly. Not a bad thing. Doesn't mean the process wasn't effective. Quite the opposite.
It led to a clarity for him of recognizing, and I should preface that in the moment, this was destabilizing for him.
Sure.
This did not feel good to him to recognize what I'm about to say so clearly, but it was in that moment that he connected the parts of his dad and his mom that had shaped the belief that I don't matter or that I'm bad. Those parts were showing up in his relationship with his wife. He had not had that awareness prior to that session. So on paper, it looks like a destabilization moment. But in later sessions, we were able to, I call it reclaiming, but able to start recognizing that it doesn't have to be the way that it was with my mom and dad. My wife is not them. But there's something about the enactments between us. There's something about the way our behavior and relationship is conducted that makes me feel like it might be true. So I want to reclaim my authenticity and identity and name this as tactfully and as kindly as I can, that there's something, and this is coaching that we did to try and get some narrative in his system for him to share with his wife, that there's something about the way that we argue that makes me feel like a little boy. And for him to get to give his wife the opportunity to show up, and thankfully she did, instead of just saying, well, that's, you know, like spinning off into a re-traumatization. But it was a beautifully and novelly intimate and vulnerable moment for him that came from that destabilization of kind of the oh shit moment that I think I married my mom and my dad put together. That did not feel good to him, but to realize that I don't have to be 8 years old again.
Well, and I just want to highlight that for many clinicians, I worry that they would feel like they'd done something wrong.
Absolutely.
And, you know, ended in that place of them actually feeling worse about their marriage when that was far from the intent of the session, I am sure. And so, like, just naming the systemic nature of what we do, that you can't pull on one string and not affect the whole thing. And that is good, right? That is generalization.
That's thorough.
Yes. And so the idea that we could keep it clean all the time is one of our fantasies as a field.
I love that. It's a wish.
It is a wish and a fantasy in a way of buffering ourselves from the fears that if there is messiness in the work, that we are somehow not doing it right. And so increasing our tolerance as a field and then as an individual practitioner, we need a large window of tolerance for complexity and mess in our work. And if we can make sense together, which is why we spend so much time talking about conceptualization, if we can make sense together of why this is the natural next step in the healing of that wound for him, then we can kind of ride that wave without panicking and bailing or without backtracking, right? We can be with rather than in reaction to.
Yes. And I think we're both pretty biased, but I think SIP is pretty sick. And I had prepared the ground for this connection with him.
Yeah.
As I had, through the case conceptualization approach, I had felt the similarities. I had not named them. That's not something that I want to pull the rug out from somebody too quick on, but I was ready for him to make that connection. And so when he did, I was able to already, even though we had like 2 minutes, we were literally like getting ready to walk out the door. I was like, I wonder what it might be like to hold on to that and be open to the ways that she's not like your mom and dad for the next week. And then it was the next session that we were able to actually unpack it. But I had already kind of anticipated that his system was feeling trapped in the silence that he, he talked about it as like a hand around his neck. A silence that he felt in his ability to advocate for his own desires and feelings with his wife, that was exactly the way he felt when he was eight. Yeah.
Yeah. That makes so much sense. Well, and this is a much larger topic that I will name and then maybe we'll move on and, see lots of other episodes where we talk more thoroughly.
We're only in phase five right now,
But I do have a personal bias around targeting memories without knowing what schema we're really working in. And this is a good example of why, right? That, sometimes there's obvious targets where it's like, well, clearly they need to process that one. And that's true. But we still need to spend enough time in conceptualization and resourcing with the client so that we have a pretty good idea of what the connection points are to the larger thing. Because at the very least, we can capitalize on the opportunities that present themselves, like in this case. Even more dire sometimes is that when things don't go exactly as planned, if we don't know where we're at, we don't know where we're at. And it's really difficult for us to really support the client well. And so we are much more efficient. And the process, most important to me, is much more gentle to the client because you knew something to say on the way out the door that allowed that to be more integratable for him and not so scary and overwhelming, but was simply the next natural step. And so when we know what schema we're in and what those connections are, we can do that a lot more effectively.
Yeah. And I don't want to come across as like, I knew the right answer. I have many experiences before. One is standing out to me where a similar connection was made. This is with a woman. And she wrote me an email later that night after the session that I told my husband that he is just like my dad. And like, nice. No, that's not.
That's not what I meant.
Dang it.
But that, that's part of the enactment. Like it actually gave her permission to maybe express some of what needed to be expressed. And we're going to conceptualize that too. Yeah. Ooh, hello, strategy.
Yeah. I was just like tweaking like parts of you remind me of my dad. Like that's.
It is possible in some moments that you have characteristics that are similar.
That would be gentler, like more gentle. But
the black and white.
She put it in all bold in the email. I told him, "You are just like my dad!" Exclamation point.
Well, we're still in child activation then.
That's right, and us therapists are always in process. But I think that's where you mentioned it just before. Just to name it, I think without preparing the ground and taking case conceptualization out and throughout, not just phase one, but all of the phases, it's going to create a sensation that the therapist did something wrong in a destabilization right. moment. Like
that's right.
If you're not ready, it's, yep. it's to me almost inevitable that you're going to feel something like that.
Absolutely. Well, and this is skipping phase six. So I don't want to do that too much, but you know, Francine talks a lot about debriefing on 157 yeah. and on in the chapter. And that, like, there's sort of a vagueness about debriefing. It's like, well, what the heck are we actually saying in the debrief? Are we just recounting what we just did? Well, maybe, but if you have taken time to conceptualize the schema that we were working in, really effective debriefing is actually putting the work that we just did in the larger context of the whole conceptualization of the case, right? Of, oh, isn't this interesting? An example of that, I did a pretty standard phase four process with somebody yesterday, and it was about a reaction that she was having to one of her children becoming sexually active for the first time. It's appropriate. Child is an adult. And it's okay that this is happening. Nothing wrong is going on, but there was still a reaction to it.
Yeah. Feelings about it.
Yeah. The natural feelings. Right. So, we both had the larger conceptualization and maybe at the beginning, me more explicitly, that I bet this is connected to the larger schema of religiosity that this person grew up in.
Yeah. Sexuality and religiosity.
Yeah. Like somehow I think that we're going to get back there. Well, it didn't come up in phase four, but it did come up in phase seven. Right. And that was sort of the moment, the aha moment of, oh, no wonder I was reacting this way. Right. No wonder I was having all of these feelings. And there was a lot of really great ahas in the debriefing that to me almost felt like another round of phase four.
Yeah, and, for sure.
But that is contingent on us conceptualizing how does this target fit in the larger schema of what we're working on.
Yeah, this does plug us back in to finish phase five, where she puts float back right here. And there's lots of opinions about, and I think well-articulated opinions about using float back more diversely. But in the way the text is written, getting into how a target might be attached to earlier memories that keep it from reaching a zero or a seven. And the language being, when is the first time you remember feeling this way? But I want to read a sentence that gave me feelings. On 153, last paragraph, typically until the early memories that cause the blocking dysfunction are reprocessed, a completely successful treatment of the original target trauma cannot be attained. So for me, I think it comes back to this nuancing that we're trying to do with this back to basic season, because blocking dysfunction, that word right there, really hard for me, because dysfunction assumes a correct function, right. And that's not real. Every human being is going to make meaning of their emerging life force in different ways. And for a memory to be hung up, you know, a target that we're actively trying to work through is being hung up by feeder memories, whatever language you use to that. That to me is a gift of phase five, where we're starting to realize that we now have some breadcrumbs to follow with our ecological one or two, or our, you know, six or five or four on the Vogue scale. Like, that is the whole point to me of what we're doing here. Like, it's not necessarily to discover these blocking dysfunctions in their life. It's to understand the stories that make up the person that came to our office. And that really represents the work we're trying to do of helping them look at the real. You know, right. Look at all that actually happened. And we bury things for good reason. We put rocks on top of stuff for good reason. And sometimes we can kick one over in our installation phase and realize, oh shit, there's so much more underneath this. Yeah. I don't want in any way in our language, in our implicit behavior, in the way we guide our sessions, for there to be shame-oriented concepts anywhere close to that. And absolutely. Blocking dysfunction to me is a dangerous one. Because it assumes a lot.
Yeah. Another like very connected to what you're saying in the discussion on page 157 about how we provide containment between sessions. One of the things that I have just felt so puzzled about, and I think you just hit on the answer to my question, is why as EMDR therapists are we not taught to intentionally partner with the dissociative abilities of a traumatized system? Right? Why are we messing with things like a Ticey's log that feels like the most arbitrary activity? It feels like an activity that may or may not be helpful. And if it is, then let clients use it. I'm not saying it could never be helpful. But the vast majority of humans that we're working with come in preloaded with really remarkable containment ability, right? And so if we didn't have this bias against dissociative maybe we wouldn't need so much arbitrary containment. Like maybe we could evoke the natural containment and suppression ability of the human organism that is always functionally repressing what is intolerable, right? Yes. And if we knew how to evoke that and welcome it, and instead of seeing it as an enemy of the process, of seeing it as a constant ally to the process, I wonder if we wouldn't need to be doing so much constant containment. Right. Yes. Like, because the body knows how to do it, it absolutely knows how to do it.
Yeah. And for the listener, just to take it out of our institute prism that we naturally operate in, for the listener, like, these containment strategies, I think, are hard for people to understand initially because we're still so colonized in our thinking around what is adaptive and maladaptive functioning. Like, yes, these repressive strategies don't look fun. Like, they're not, well, I just named the feeling, and then I, like, all these cognitively oriented kind of assumptions. A lot of people's strategies are things that they have insecurities about, like things that they have shame around, like, just to name one, like addiction oriented strategies, or exactly.
Over exercise, you know, under eating, exactly. Right? All of those are repressive mechanisms. Yeah.
Yes. And they are containers. They are things that function the way that we want containers to. They just point them to more distress. So that's what we're trying to reshape into authentic expression. But the mm-hmm. containment idea, I totally agree. I think it's our own affect phobia, not to hit on a trope that we just seem to be obsessed with on this podcast, but it's so important that I think it's our own affect phobia that insists on containing before it gets out of control, quote unquote. Right. And that is a really subjective moving target.
Yeah. Or prioritizing the containers that we have given the client permission to use.
Exactly. Oh, I love like that language.
Right. That is really tricky. Super, super concerning to me because that body knows how to take care of itself. Now, every once in a while, we get a client that is like really struggling with containment ability, and they're in a constant flood. So we need to know how to do it in case they need it. But if they've already figured out 14 ways to provide containment in their system, and even if some of them make us uncomfortable, like who are we to say, don't do that if that's the thing that's going to help? And they are so, clients tend to be very sensitive to our judgment of their quote unquote coping skills. Right. And we seem to think that we're going to upgrade their coping skills to ones that are more adaptive, right? Better. And maybe that could be true if they're actually dangerous and harmful. But I just think it's a really slippery slope when we become the arbiter of how somebody contains what has been distressing and overwhelming to them. Absolutely. And I don't want a client to spend their energy trying to learn how to use a Ticey's log when their ability to dissociate by playing, you know, Royal Match or Candy Crush for 2 hours was working just fine. It was working, right? Like, so I clearly had a bit of a soapbox about all this, but.
Well, I have a client that was coming to my mind while you were talking. At the end of a pretty intense session, she, upon standing up to leave the office, said, "Time for my therapy cigarette."
Yes,
and that that was a perfect example to me of like, okay, all right,
she knows what she needs.
That's your process.
Yeah, and if we can de-shame the ways that they have survived, then we are actually working on the therapeutic goal of reducing shame in the system as a whole, which to me is way more interesting than upgrading their coping skills. hands down, way more useful.
And they'll find the coping skill that will feel better when the shame goes down.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so, maybe we should do a whole thing on
topic. But just to name, neither of us or anyone at Beyond like recommend self-harming behaviors or anything like that. But we acknowledge their intimate discovery of those strategies as containment oriented behaviors discovered very early on in life.
100%.
This is where, again, not to be misunderstood, we're not here saying, yep, go drink a case of beer after this session. I never say that. But I do recognize the utility of the discovery of that strategy for that individual. And I do not want them to feel shame about that. I want them to feel invited and able to process why the connection to that strategy feels so inescapable.
Completely. And this is something that if we are not explicitly de-shaming, the client will naturally feel embarrassed because they most likely have already been shamed for it. Case in point, I was on the phone with a client yesterday who is in crisis trying to leave an abusive relationship. And I texted her and she hadn't responded, which is rare. So I call her and she said, I didn't want to answer because I was afraid that you would be mad at me because I got back together with this person. Right. That is exactly what we're talking about, that I understand why she is still in this pattern. And I don't want her to feel shame because shame leads to isolation.
Yes. Right?
Which leads to a re-perpetration of the trauma that we're working on in the first place. So this is just an area where I think like our humility is essential.
Yeah.
And partnering with the natural dissociative containment and repressive abilities that they are coming preloaded with, to me, is much more efficient than trying to fuss with them. Let them use what works.
Not to get too biological about it, but isolation means death. Like if you pull a leaf off of a plant, the plant might be okay, but the leaf will die.
And that connection and that feeling of I'm with you no matter what is going to end up being way more important than me trying to help her cope differently with her feelings than being in this relationship.
Yeah. But that's your belief in a three-person psychology.
That is.
Yes. So for those folks that might believe in a single-person psychology, that's going to be really hard to take, but it's an invitation.
If you're super into self-regulation, then we can talk. Please let me talk to you. I would love to understand.
Yep. Love to understand. Beautiful. Well, we've got 27 minutes to talk about phase six.
We can do it.
I just think it's an unfortunate perpetuation of the culturally situated irrelevance around the body scan. Like it's just something you just do and you just like get through it. If it's clear, you're great. Like
I'm pretty sure that between you and me, Bridger, we can make it very clear that we don't feel that way in 24 minutes.
A compelling case at least.
Yes. All right. Shall we begin then?
Sure.
Okay. I'm ready. I'm gonna give a thought first. My first desire would be to suggest that the body scan not happen first in this point in the treatment process. If phase six is the first time that you're doing some kind of body scan, then you're probably going to run into issues in phase six. So one of the most effective ways of working with phase six process is to have practiced it many times. And this is simply the final time that we're going to check in. If it's the first time, we're probably going to have some issues. And at the very least, we probably stayed in cognitive land in our processing. So my preference is that the body scan is happening in and throughout. And this is simply the final round. We're resuming.
Including phase one. Like,
yeah.
All throughout. Yes. I think all that's, again, something that is so native to the Institute, but it can start in really practical and small ways. Like in the first session, even pick up on the feeling and don't let that be another thought. Like pick up on the feeling and ground it in the body. Even if saying like, is there like a movement that goes along with that? Like you're telling me about your frustration at work, like, but you're just telling me about it. What is, what's the body saying about any of that? Like familiarizing and perhaps intentionally reconnecting the brain back into the body. Wouldn't that be cool? But to recognize, I think that that is a political act in speaking against the distinction between the brain and body that our culture perpetuates. Again, not to get on another soapbox, we've already done like six today, but to just again recognize that a lot of clients are going to come in feeling activation about the idea of talking about the worst things in their life. And one of our most culturally celebrated ways of buffering against that is just to intellectualize it, turn it into thought, turn it into cognition, get away from those scary feelings in the body. To recognize fundamentally that upon first interacting with a client, that's more than likely, again, just based in my experience, more than likely the operating system that's going to be creating activation and cognition in their system.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I, you know, if you ever find yourself thinking, I think that reprocessing needs to go deeper. Well, take yourself very literally. What you're saying is we need to go to the body. Because there's something that we're sensing that says, oh, this material is staying in the realm of the logical, the realm of the cognitive self, and not really penetrating the all of the cells and the selves beneath. And, you know, and I know that traditionally in EMDR Basic, we're not given a long list of body-based interweaves, right? So we're not necessarily being given some kind of, you know, somatic psychology 101. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So very briefly, just to, as a point of experimentation, if you want to go deeper with the body, remember that sensation is always communication. So when you ask that question, where do you feel it in your body? And they tell you, I feel it in my chest. And you're wondering, what in the world do I do next? Interpret that as communication from the body, right? The body is now telling you something. And it uses sensation and symbol, which often comes in the form of either more sensation or images, to try to get its point across. And so we're not just going to notice, oh, there's sensation. How interesting. We're going to turn our attention to it and say, and now what do you want to show us, right? What is more, right? So questions such as you notice that sensation in your body, is there any symbol or image that emerges that goes with it? Or is there any impulse that you feel as you notice that sensation? Does your body want to do something with that feeling? What comes next, right? So if we start doing this in phase four and all of the phases before, by the time we get to body scan, the body is used to being listened to, right? And we have practiced listening. And so we're going to have a much more effective experience. I like clear body scan straight out of the gate the first time that we do it in phase six, because I want to have already found any of that lingering stuff, because we're including it all along the way. If there's a whole bunch of stuff in your body scan, try to go deeper the next time with the body so that it's not being left behind so much.
Yeah. In the assessment, in the, yeah, in phases three through five. Yes, absolutely. And I recognize that. I wish I could hear and process with each of the listeners what this is doing for them. Like if it's creating a sensation of, I don't know how to do that. I don't feel comfortable with that language. What is it doing for you? Because that to me, again, it's our bias for sure. But that to me is the whole purpose of being in therapy, is in part to connect the brain back to the body, to feel as well as see or as as understand. And
I want to make a distinction there, because, and you and I have talked about this, that the brain is part of the body.
Yes.
Right. And so I this is just a struggle with language, you guys, like, because we're not culturally used to talking about this in a useful way. So what I have been experimenting with, and I'm curious how this feels to you, Bridger, is that maybe it's more like connecting ourself back to our body, not our brain back to our body. They're already together. There's no way for them to not be. But where the disconnect is the locus of our sense of self, right? Where do I place me? Where does me exist? And we want our sense of me to be located in all of ourselves, not just in our brain.
Yeah. I think for me, this is just a multifaceted problem that shows up in every facet of psychotherapy culture, of psychology culture, really. Like when anybody's talking about an interaction in the mind, there's a brain-mind problem. There's a brain-body problem. There are things that fragment and ultimately reduce the experience of being human to a parts or whole distinction.
Yeah.
Like, which are we talking about? And for me, connect the brain back to the body. I teach that way because I want to acknowledge that more than likely you believe they're two different things. I know mm-hmm. they're not. And you mm-hmm. ultimately do know that they're not. But mm-hmm. to you, the mind and the body are the same thing, mm-hmm. more than likely. Mm-hmm. And so to connect the brain back to the body sets up a scaffolding pedagogy for me to where then I can say, actually, the brain and body are one thing, and the mind mm-hmm. is an emergent process from that whole brain idea.
Yeah. And even from that whole organism, then in relationship to an environment.
Yes. Including other organisms. Yeah.
And this is, I think, like where our three-person psychology actually comes in, is that it's more like a person and environment self-confidence. Well, it's,
yeah. You, me in between. Yeah.
You, me, the everything around us.
Yes, exactly right. Exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
So with that, the body scan is one page in one, mm-hmm. in this chapter, 154, a page and a paragraph. Mm-hmm. But moving then from the validity of cognition scale and the idea of installation in phase 5, this is the standard protocol's way of grounding the experience of phases 4, 5, and 6 ultimately into the body. Mm-hmm. So there's a script given in the text, and its intention is to explore the tension, tightness, or unusual situation within the body as we reflect on the installation that we just did.
Yeah. Yeah. And the noticing of what emerges in that activation then may take us back into phase 4. If we identify distress and we're not getting neutral or positive reaction to, holding attention there.
I want to make a point here where I think for us at Beyond, what we discover in the body scan, let's say we're, we find some tension in the chest, I think is an example that you used.
Mm-hmm.
I want to explore that in a way that doesn't kick us back into cognitive mode.
Right.
But to be able to give some right hemisphere language to flesh mm-hmm. out the sensation detected in the body. So if it is tension in the chest, I'm not going to say, and what does that mean to you? Like, I'm not going to like just softball their left hemisphere a intellectualization right. off ramp. I'm not going to do that. Mm-hmm. What I'm going to do is try and pick it up and see if there is a shape to it, if there is a texture to it, if there's a color to it, if there's a sound to it, like use those empirical senses. This is what I do in my office, use those empirical senses to help give that implicit meaning, but in a way that keeps it activated, that doesn't right. give them, the parachute to go back into cognitive land.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you guys, feel a little rusty on how to do that, your Lightstream script is going to be good inspiration for how to engage a sensation as it emerges. And then there is space as well to invite communication from, which is very different than activating the cognitive self. We can ask the sensation, do you want to share anything? right? And share to me is almost better than say, because then we open up to communication through image and through different sensation, through movement. And as long as it is doing something, right? As long as the communication is continuing, then we continue to let it go and process the way that we would in phase four until we come to some kind of natural resolution. That said, you know, Francine does make the point that if we start the body scan and there's a lot of activation there and we have 5 minutes left in session, maybe best to pause and do closure of an incomplete session and then come back and reactivate to really give the body time to communicate what it needs to communicate. Because we have to remember, our clients are conscious of time in the session sometimes.
Yeah.
They know when they only have 5 minutes left. And so
for sure, you can see them start to gather their things or
put
the tears away or
You know, so if there is a lot going on there, don't try to launch into it if you don't have the time and the space to really give it what it needs in order to, because it makes it feel like it's not as important.
Yeah.
And we want communicating that this sensation, even if we don't fully understand what it holds yet, is incredibly important to us and it's going to get its own time.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So just to reiterate on the body scan, we would love for this not to be the first time you're doing it. And that your utilization of the purpose and function of the body scan will be supported by your preceding familiarization of this idea, this phenomenology, way of exploring experience with your client and you as the therapist. And that given the results of the body scan, we could either go back into phase four or land the plane, whether it be complete or incomplete, depending on the time and resources available to us.
Yeah. And I would add that we remember that the goal of focusing on the body is not to relax the body, right? The goal is to listen to the body. So when we come to do a body scan, regardless of which phase we're in, there might be times in resourcing where we're intentionally practicing relaxation skills, but we have to be careful to not send the message that a good body is a relaxed, calm body, right? That's not what we're aiming for. So we're going to facilitate deep listening and really invite, right? Give a lot of permission and invitation for the body to communicate, to get louder, to get bigger, to demonstrate what it needs to demonstrate and express what it needs to express so that it is brought along through the whole process and is not ignored.
One of the ways I talk with my clients about this is through voice and choice. Voice being a authentic and thorough exploration of sensation and where it came from, both in the present and in the past, and then the emergent meaning of it as it pertains to your authentic expression, which is the choice element. So once we empower an authentic and thorough voice and exploration of self and sensation in the present and in the past, we can then have more opportunity to evaluate what would it feel like to choose an expression that honors this newfound voice that we have. And that's where ultimately for me, installation, body scan, and closure are pointed into empowering authentic expression and choice.
Absolutely. And, you know, there is so much more that we want to say about involving the body in this process. And there are several chapters coming up in the book that is going to give us space to do that more thoroughly. So, you know, when we get to chapter 9 and 10 in particular, when we're looking at special situations and interweaving and things like that, we'll have the body front and center, because I think it was you, Bridger, that I recently said the body is the royal road to the subconscious.
That's right.
I really believe that. So we'll talk a lot about different ways of engaging in this way.
Yes. And to land the plane, phase 7, to me, the purpose of phase 7 is to set up phase 8 in the next iteration of whatever our time together will be, whether that be from a complete session where we've got a 0-7 and clear, or we have an incomplete session where there's some rocks unturned, some sensation still lingering, some distress, etc. And in phase 8, then in reevaluation, again, of a closed, you know, a complete close or an incomplete close, we get to choose the direction and focus of the therapeutic relationship in the next encounter. Mm-hmm. Cool. Any other?
And that's closure.
Any other thoughts?
Yeah. I don't think so. I did want to mention to everybody that we've got certification cohorts filling right now. So I think I've got maybe 2 seats in mine for May left. And then you're starting one in June.
Yeah. Just opened registration for that. So
yeah.
If you're interested. So,
yeah. And if this is tantalizing to you and you're ready to take the next step and climb the EMDR capitalism ladder, name what it is explicitly, which
good,
comes with
good all. Sell. Good sell, Melissa. Right. That's
well, I believe in honesty.
Absolutely.
It comes with many great benefits, but truly it is just the best way to go in deep on all of these concepts. And the amount of detail that we get to get into in the 20 hours that we spend together is just so enriching. And then you get to make it personal to your cases, your population. And we also get to get into some relevant things like our own enactments and fantasies and patterns that may or may not be showing up in our EMDR process.
Just be curious about that. Yeah.
Might be occasionally. So.
Yeah. And if you've ever thought, I want help with my toughest cases, that's probably where we're going to start, is in those unconscious fantasies and enactments.
No, that's a sell. Come get certified and we'll unearth your unconscious fantasies.
I mean, okay.
Yeah. We do.
All right. Well, thank you all for listening. We really hope you enjoy the episode and stick around for more.
We hope that you have enjoyed this podcast episode and that it will help you help your clients in the process of EMDR therapy. If you are curious to learn more about something that you've heard today, check out our website at www.beyondhealingcenter.com and go to the trainings tab for more information on our upcoming EMDR and case conceptualization trainings. You can also contact us by emailing trainings@beyondhealingcenter.com. If you want to stay connected, please subscribe to this podcast for more episodes, leave us a review, and follow us on social media by searching Notice That Podcast.